From the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G Scott and Ursula Voitine.
Good morning, happy Thursday, and thank you for listening to the G and Ursula Show. Let me check in with my favorite friend. Good morning, Ursula.
Good morning. We're already off to a better start than yesterday, I'm going to tell you.
Hold on, Ursula. Let's be honest here. Start the show.
Yes.
I'm down in Tacoma.
Uh-huh.
You're in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
How you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. We have so many things. People don't understand what goes into a show and how many things have to work. There is something really cool that's happened. Oh. We have someone back today, and we need to say hello to him.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back, Chef. Man, it is so good to have Chef back on the show. I got to tell you, it feels like a Saturday and a Sunday because now I get to relax with having Chef back, Ursula.
And can he hear us now? Because we do have a new board op.
He did tell us not to go to him.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Yeah, so yeah. In any case, he is back. We got to meet baby Alice, who was absolutely adorable. And so anyway, the funny thing is doing a show where none of us see each other. Mm-hmm. It's more challenging than anyone can imagine, but let's just put it that way.
No, you wanted to give our listeners an example of that, so you went to Chef just now. Chef wasn't there, and see, our listeners got to hear firsthand what happens.
Absolutely.
All right, let's get to it. Because, look, I got to tell you, one of your top five stories, I'm not exaggerating. I was laughing so hard that I was in tears. I cannot wait until, and you don't even know which one.
Oh,
one
I think I know. I think I know.
I was laughing so hard, I was in tears. Let's get to it. Ursula's top five news stories of the day, brought to you by Economy Fence Center.
And now, kids between the ages of 12 and 15 are eligible for the two-dose Pfizer vaccine, and many actually started getting their shots yesterday. Assistant Health Secretary Michelle Roberts says about 650,000 doses are available throughout the state.
We know the Pfizer vaccine has been proven to be safe and extremely effective, and we're thrilled so many people are eager to vaccinate their children, myself included.
And she says these vaccines are critical in getting kids back to school.
It's the best step we can take to ensure our kids are healthy, remain in the classroom, can safely spend time with their friends, and take part in extracurricular activities.
But for now, they are only going to be recommended and not mandated for students.
Well, right now, it's not being mandatory for students. I mean, that's a great thing. But one thing that needs to be out there is the health director, Key County's health director, Jeff Duchin, and him saying how nationwide adolescents and young children account for 20% of COVID cases right now, Ursula. And I didn't know it was that high. But to know that number lets you know just how important it is and maybe something that we are going to really have to look at as we approach having students in person, all in person, coming up this school year.
Okay, so for you, G, and everyone who's listening right now, here's my question for you. Okay. If you have or if you had a child in this age group, would you get them vaccinated right now?
Ursula, can we move on to the next topic? All right. So you first asked me this question on Monday, I believe. And even then I was hesitant about it on then because I was like, I don't have a 12-year-old or 12 to 15-year-old. And then I've been thinking about it more and I've had some conversations with some friends about it. And if I had a 12-year-old, now this is, I'm going to be honest, I don't feel comfortable saying this, because I know there's already vaccine hesitancy. But at the same time, I don't know how not to tell the truth. If I had a 12-year-old, no, I would not rush to go get my 12-year-old the vaccine, Ursula. If I had a 15-year-old, I might be closer to doing it there.
So what's the difference between those 3 years to you? It's just your comfort level.
I think my comfort level is kind of like the 12-year-old, 15. It's like, hey, would you let your 12-year-old drive or would you let your 15-year-old drive, right? Like, I'm being serious about what I'm saying, and I'm telling you the truth. Even though I don't feel comfortable answering your question on the air, because I don't want people to take that as, oh, G doesn't like the vaccine. I'm just not going to lie to you. And if I had a 12-year-old, I would not feel comfortable with my 12-year-old getting a vaccine.
Okay, so let's talk. Yeah, so let's talk this through. So I will tell you that if my kids were in that age bracket and they were perfectly healthy, had not gotten any reactions to previous vaccines, I would ask their pediatrician,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully most people have pediatricians who they trust,
right.
and I would ask, are you getting the child for your vaccine? That is what I've always done with our pediatrician. We've had the same pediatrician for my boys. In fact, I cried when my oldest aged out because I love her that much. But you trust them, and then you ask, what is it that you would do for your own child? That my children deal with the consequences of the vaccine than the potential long-term effects of COVID. That's me. Now, I know that people think completely differently. There are going to be people who send me, did you hear about this? Did you hear about that? Mm-hmm. But for the parents who say they want to wait and see, like you too.
Sure.
You want to wait and see how the vaccine works. How long is the appropriate amount of time to wait? Is that 5 years? Is that 10 years? How much do you have to see? That's another question I have for you. How much do you have to see
to
feel comfortable about it?
Okay, I'll answer that. I believe that the majority of us, we wait and see based on who might get it that we might trust in our tree, in our family or in our friend groups or something like that. And, oh, okay, and you might have a conversation. But I don't know. I mean, it's not any, quote, research. It's like I've never seen anybody go inside of a lab and says, oh, no, gee, you take this algebraic and this engineering response, and I've written journals. You don't get it from that. So I think it's their comfort level.
Which is why I have to go with the experts that I trust. Okay, and Chef, do we have you on right now? Because Chef is of the, he has younger children. And I believe that during our morning meeting, Chef said that he would have no hesitancy in getting his kids vaccinated. What I don't like, though, and let me just say this, because I think we're still having technical issues. But what I don't agree with is what happened in Olympia, where the school district encouraged parents to lie about their kids' birthdays so that they could cheat the system and then jump the gun for vaccine appointments. This was before Pfizer was even approved for 12 to 15-year-olds, and the district had suggested using the wrong birthdays as what they called a workaround placeholder. And so since then, the district has said, yeah, that was our bad. We shouldn't have done that. That was a poorly thought-out temporary solution. We regret the communication error. To me, it's those kind of sneaky things that make people more distrustful.
Wait.
Or,
you mean to tell me, wait, is that real, Ursula?
That is absolutely real.
Yeah. No. A school district did this? You mean to tell me there wasn't one person that said, hey, we should not be encouraging something like this?
The school district has now admitted that they made a mistake. So, and then there's that other thing where that other school district was trying to encourage people. The thing is, I understand we want to fully open. You heard Heather's breaking news. The, Seattle school district says, yes, people are going to be going back this fall. And I would be okay getting my kids the vaccine, but I don't think you can force families to get the vaccine at the younger ages. I'm okay with it after they're adults and in college, but some of these younger ages, I understand. I even understand what you're saying, but for me, I would have a different decision. So things are looking up, though, G, because the COVID curve in Washington is no longer going up.
Statewide, the case counts began flattening in mid-April. We have now seen some hopeful signs of hospital admissions also appear to be flattening or plateauing as well.
State Health Secretary Dr. Umair Shah says this shows that the vaccine and other precautions that you've all been doing are working. King County's COVID cases have dropped 20% in 1 week. Hospitalization rates are down as well. Snohomish County is expected to remain in phase 3, so I think that's good news. But Whatcom County is in danger of joining Pierce County in rolling back to phase two, and that is frustrating to restaurant owners who spoke to Cairo 7.
I have no problem at all firmly stating that this industry has been hit the absolute hardest.
So there's a lot of good news, but some counties are still struggling. I got to ask you.
Huh.
Should the state redo the metrics in determining these rollbacks? What do you want to hear from the governor next Tuesday?
I want the governor to just open things up. As a matter of fact, and here's why
Regardless of numbers.
Here's why I'm saying that. According to Andy Slavitt, who is the White House advisor to COVID response, just yesterday, he says the COVID-19 positivity rate is 3.5% right now. It's at an all-time low since this pandemic has started. To give more context to what I just said, it was 20% in January.
Mm-hmm.
Like you just heard that restaurant owner or worker say, the restaurant industry has been devastated through this. Would y'all please just let these restaurants get back to business and doing things? Can we vaccinations are happening. There is a reason why there is kind of the cases counts are kind of going down. I'm not saying that the cases aren't out there, but we're starting to get better with this. And by the way,
and Pierce County, can you just keep going? Because right now they actually should be, according to the metrics, down in phase one. So can we just keep encouraging everybody, keep doing the right thing, because we need to have a plan to reopen, a better plan to reopen, clear plan to reopen.
Do you think Pierce County restaurants, do you think they should be able to open? Do you think they should be in phase
one? Yeah, I think the restaurants at this point are taking too much of the brunt.
Okay.
But again, I just feel like we can't lose the sight of the message that we still need to do a good job of continuing to bring it down, and there are some counties that are not quite there. Well, we are now being told that Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin's iPhone was set to automatically delete texts that were older than 30 days. That is the explanation that her office is now giving after a whistleblower investigation showed that her text messages are missing from a 10-month period that includes the peak of last year's Black Lives Matter demonstrations. Toby Nixon is an expert on our state's open records law, and he tells Cairo 7 TV, these missing text messages are considered potential evidence in a federal lawsuit over a murder in the CHOP zone last summer.
And I assume that the Seattle mayor received training, and so she really has no excuse to not know that you can't automatically delete records after 30 days.
A spokesperson for the mayor says the city has been able to retrieve many of the mayor's messages now, but not all of them. I knew that was the one you were laughing at. Okay, I looked at my iPhone yesterday. I was like, how do I have to? Because right now, it's you can keep them forever, those text messages, right?
Oh, no.
Wait.
Okay. Look, I apologize. I'm sorry. Just hear me out. Hear me out, everybody. According to the city attorney's office, that gap was caused by, wait a minute, wait for it. It was caused by, quote, a retention setting that was in her iPhone. You mean to tell me, out of all the times that I've gotten in trouble in my past over text messages and things being what, I could have always said, I'm sorry, but there's a retention setting on my phone. Now, here's the kicker.
Well, retention setting is the nice way of saying someone shut it down.
Wait. Okay. Here's the kicker, Ursula. Here's the part that had me laughing so hard that I could not control myself, and it made me so happy to do the show with you today.
Okay.
Isn't it ironic that the mayor, the police chief, and the fire chief all had the same thing?
And about five other people, the five most critical people.
I mean, you want to talk about peeing on somebody's leg and saying, no. Nick Allert said it's going to rain today.
Okay, I know. It's funny, but for the people who are trying to get this as evidence, it's not so funny. And so what do you do? Right. I mean, clearly they think we're stupid and that we're going to buy this idea that, oh, oops, especially someone who was a former U.S. attorney. She is a sharp legal mind. I'm sorry. But to say you had no idea and these things could disappear, and golly, it just seems so convenient that the very people who were involved in so much of the decision making, they all had the same problems with their iPhones. Yeah, that's a tough one. Well, while most states are offering incentives like ice cream, donuts, and beer to get the COVID vaccine, Ohio is taking it to a whole new level. They're giving their residents a shot at winning $1 million.
This is money that we got from the federal government to fight the virus. And there's nothing more potent at this time to fight the virus. The only game in town really at this point is the vaccine. And everybody that we can get vaccinated, it fights the virus better.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine says starting May 26th, the state is going to draw one vaccine recipient to win $1 million. That's going to happen every week for 5 weeks. And they're also going to be giving full ride public college scholarships to teens. To teens who get vaccinated against COVID-19.
Both of my sons are in Ohio right now, and that is all people are talking about right now. All you got to do is you got to be registered to vote, Ursula. If you're registered to vote, you're in there drawing, you get your vaccine, you have that opportunity to do so. By the way, 10 days ago, our very own Dave Ross gave the suggestion about this state doing the same thing, doing it kind of like a lottery, if you will. I think that this is a genius idea. I think it's great. It goes back to what you said, Ursula, the whole, hey, come get a six pack of beer stuff. That wasn't working.
Yeah, absolutely. And then he explained a couple other things, too. For example, he says he knows there are going to be people who never get the vaccine, more than 40% in Ohio. They're already immunized. So it's really the ones on the fence that they're targeting with these big prizes.
Well, I call the persuadables in the middle. And it's not just getting them to do it. Some of them may eventually do it. But getting people to be vaccinated now as opposed to a month or 2 months from now.
Got to hand it to him. I think they came up with a winner.
Some people, I got some messages already asking me how dare I laugh about those texts. What am I supposed to do? I mean, I'm laughing about the story. Like, hey, sorry, we don't have those texts.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to react?
Well, I mean, I think the other way would be angry and frustrated that something so dumb could happen. Anyway, still ahead, King County is going to be buying several hotels to house up to 1,600 homeless people. Is this going to be the answer? We'll take a look at that, and we have a guest to help us understand. You are listening to The G and Ursula Show. It is 9:34. Welcome back to the G and Ursula Show, Thursday morning edition. As we have told you, King County plans to take an extraordinary step in the fight to end homelessness. This is an effort that wasn't even on the table before the pandemic began. The county is planning to buy up hotels with the goal of housing up to 1,600 homeless people in the next couple of years. We know you have questions. We also have questions. So we have invited Leo Floor, the director of the King County Department of Community and Human Services, to join us on the show this morning. Hi, Leo.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So tell us how this is going to work. I know that the county executive said the county will be buying the inn at Queen Anne. So walk us through that. What is the plan?
Absolutely. So we know that the thing that works for folks who are experiencing chronic homelessness is to get them inside. And we have a moment right now where we have a hotel industry that's been really affected by the COVID pandemic. We have an opportunity with a new revenue source that we're calling Health Through Housing. And we certainly have the need in our community with at least 4,000 people experiencing chronic unsheltered homelessness. And what we're going to do is build off of what we learned in our COVID response, buy hotels when they're cheaper than they normally would be, so that we can create housing faster than we normally could and get folks inside.
I just want to say that I'm excited about the idea, and Ursula and I, we talked about it yesterday. However, I'm skeptical about the execution. What's going to be so much different with this going forward as it was to, let's just say, what they did over in Renton when it came to kind of similar to this?
Absolutely. I heard this skepticism yesterday, G, and so I think the big difference in what we're doing now is this is housing. We're giving folks a place to live, a place to form a community, and a place to receive services. And so what we learned is that the ability to, you know, sleep, to lock your door, to have a place where you can keep your prescription medicine, to be able to use the bathroom without signing up, makes all the difference initially to get people inside. And then I agree with you. It is, how do we get the services on site that we can use to support people so that they can come back from that experience of unsheltered homelessness? And when we're talking about chronically homeless folks, you know, these are folks who have a disability by definition, who've been living outside for at least 12 months or at least three times in the last 12 months. And those are the folks that we're really looking to bring inside, provide the services. And we know that it works because we've done it. And that's what the University of Washington helped prove. And so we have the pattern now to do this at scale. And so execution looks like learning from what we've already done and now taking it to scale.
You, when you bring up services, one of the questions that I also have, I have a bunch of them, and who will be supplying these services? Who are some folks that will be overseeing some of these services at this place?
This is super important. We know that in order to be effective, we have to have service providers that have both the expertise and the relationships to make the services work. So some examples. We work right now with Catholic Community Services. We work with the Chief Seattle Club. We work with the Downtown Emergency Services Center. And these are folks who have both the community connections, but also can do things like administer Medicaid-funded behavioral health services. So if somebody needs job placement, housing search assistance, or help with a substance use disorder, these service providers that we're selecting can provide all of that.
Leo, one of the big complaints that I've seen on social media regarding this plan is that some people, some critics say, this is just giving the message that everybody who's homeless or who wants to take advantage of all the great things that the Seattle area provides, come on over, and it's not going to actually impact positively the homelessness crisis, but just encourage more people to get here. What do you say to respond to that?
Yeah, I hear that message too, and I think this is where it's really important to understand who we're trying to help here. When we say a person experiencing chronic homelessness, again, these are folks who must have slept outside for the last 12 months or three times in the last 12 months, and they all, by definition, have to have a disabling condition. So that's the requirements for eligibility for these places. These are folks who have been living outside for a very long time. We have unfortunately all seen people living, whether it's in parks, intense, and this is an effort to bring them inside. And so I think one of the big, what I call myths is that, you know, people would come to Seattle to live outside for a year just for a chance to live in a hotel. And what we instead see is that most people want to be housed. They want to have a chance to work if they can. They want to be connected to families, and this is really a path to do that.
And Leo, you're making a great point, because one of the other things that I hear too is, oh, wow, so we're talking about permanent housing, meaning they can live in the hotel forever and it's going to be taxpayers funding that. It sounds like your goal is to get them to be independent, and this would be just getting them off the street and working with them so that they can live independent lives.
That's right. Whenever we can, we are trying to support a person to get a job, get permanent housing on their own. And for a lot of people, that's the goal. And for a lot of people, they can succeed when they have the foundation of housing. I think it's also really important for credibility to be clear that there are some folks who are so disabled that it's not realistic for them to live independently. And particularly amongst people who experience chronic homelessness, We see that we are caring for them as a society, whether that it's through jails and emergency rooms or housing. But we know that housing is both cheaper and better for people. And so that's really the better way for us to care for these folks.
Leo, I got the million-dollar question, man. I got the million-dollar question. How will this be paid for?
Absolutely. So last year in September, the King County Council enacted a sales tax. It's 0.1% sales tax. And so that's enacted. We're collecting it now. And this program will be paid for entirely through that funding source. So it's sales tax that will generate about $50 million a year, but we're going to bond against it. That's going to allow us to bring the money forward into this year and then really take advantage of this, what we call countercyclical real estate opportunity. Hotels are cheaper right now than they have been or likely will be. When we build new permanent supportive housing, that unit usually costs about $400,000 when you account for the land and the construction costs and the size of the buildings we build. We have a chance here to cut that purchase price in half. Our target is to get the hotels that we're buying for around $200,000 a room on average. And so this is both faster and cheaper, and you don't get a lot of chances in real estate to go both faster and cheaper.
Leo, we are actually out of time, but I got 30 seconds for you. If you could explain, I know that Renton felt like they were left off the table when it came to what happened there. Are you going to get community buy-in before you do these hotels?
Absolutely. We are working with cities and communities across the county right now. This is different. With Renton, we acted quickly to save lives in the context of a COVID emergency to get people out of dangerous shelters. And now we're building long-term solutions with communities, and it will only succeed if we work together.
Leo Floor, the director of King County Department of Community and Human Services, we thank you for your time. Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
I thought he was good, Ursula. I thought he was really good. Coming up next, we need to talk. And what we need to talk about is this: the biggest COVID-related travel mistakes that some of us make. We'll discuss that next. It's Gene Ursula. Ursula Show. Coming up at 10:06, we will give you three things that you need to know. But right now, Ursula, we're going to talk about travel and some of the biggest COVID mistakes, Ursula, that are made during travel. And I'm going to get right into it. One of them is this: failing to plan ahead. Most of the time, a lot of us are making a huge mistake of not planning ahead. What I mean by that is this: rules are different, Ursula, from state to state based on the capacity of the guidelines for hotels and or restaurants or maybe national parks. So those are some of the things. Also, rental cars, is some of you have probably have like, hey, you know what? I'll go ahead and think about renting a car the night before. I don't know if you guys know this right now, but the rental car industry is wow. Like, prices right now are through the roof to rent a vehicle. So these are things you might want to plan ahead on.
Okay. Well, so now this was interesting to you because you have traveled and have you been caught flat-footed on some of these situations?
No. It's interesting to me because the reason why this article was in the Huffington Post, and it's interesting to me is that I keep seeing on social media people talking about things that they didn't know. So I'm seeing a lot of it. And right now it's the travel season that's coming up. So I thought it's important to bring that up. And plus, I know my co-hosts always love to talk travel anyways. Okay.
Now that I'm fully vaccinated, I am starting to look at trips. And in fact, we're going to go to the coast this weekend. My husband and I are going to go to the coast. But I have taken a couple of flights in recent months. One of them, I'll be honest, I didn't want to share it at the time, but I'm all about honesty. I did go to Las Vegas. And one of the things that I found that was a little bit worrisome to me was that there were huge crowds where people weren't doing what I know, you know, is safer. So, you know, first of all, it would be, well, why did I go to Vegas in the first place? But I wanted to see. I was feeling, you know, pretty good about how I have managed to stay safe and healthy, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, you know, I love Vegas. So anyway, my girlfriend and I, do you know that we had to wear masks by the side of the pool? And the only way that we could get, so I actually felt safer in my hotel, although I also thought this is annoying. And so we would only be allowed to take off our masks if we had a foot in the pool. Mm-hmm. So if you were in the pool, you could remove it. Otherwise, if you're just getting some sun on the you know, chairs, that you have to be wearing a mask. Right. And people were, they had security guards actually making sure that we do. But then when I went to other hotels and other properties, not so much. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, do it at your own risk. And I know that you're going to be taking a flight soon, too, right?
And, I think so.
Okay, and yeah, and you got to be careful too, because it used to be that the middle seat was open. Well, that's not happening anymore either.
Right. Well, I'm glad you brought up what you just said just now. You brought up the fact that you have gotten both your shots, and there's a lot of people who's like, hey, I got the vaccine, I'm good to go, I could go anywhere. And that's another thing that's on this list.
I'm better to go. I'm not, you know, yeah, I'm not.
You're better to go. So let me give you an example, and we talked about this before, but I want to make this a reminder. Let's just say you do go to Mexico with a family trip. You've been vaccinated, right? Well, in order for you to come back into the United States, you're going to have a COVID test. With that COVID test, there's still a possibility you can contract COVID still, even with the vaccine. So those are things to make sure to remember. And also, one of the things that I'm going to say that I'm guilty of is behaving differently once you get to that their destination. What's happening is we'll leave Washington State, which we all know what the state of Washington is a little bit more strict, if you will. When
a
it
lot
comes
more
to
strict.
Other,
let's get real.
When it comes to other states. Again, let me point to me. I'm guilty of this. I have left Washington State, and I've gone to other places, and I've been laxed a little bit. Just make sure you don't want to ruin your trip by getting lax and messing it up, because that just would be a bad trip on the way back. And one last thing, Ursula, to bring up that is really important, too, is knowing the requirements once you get to a destination. And what I mean by that is one of the common mistakes that are happening when people are traveling internationally right now is not knowing the rules upon entry. Like sometimes, yeah, a COVID test is necessary, but sometimes you have to be required to submit a health form or register online before departures. So all of those things to make sure you know.
And I know that Hawaii had some special rules, too. And if you've been to Hawaii recently, let us know if you had to face anything. I know a few people were saying, boy, you need to make people aware that if you're going to Hawaii, and maybe that's no longer the case with more people getting vaccinated. But in right. any case, like you said, it's good to make sure that you know what the rules are so you don't have a problem that ruins your vacation on the way home, like as in you can't get back. You can't get back home. That would be a bummer.
Absolutely. Coming up next, we're going to give you three things that you need to know. Thank you for listening to The Gene Ursula Show.